It's The Takeaway for May 16th. I'm Tanzina Vega. School segregation in the United States is on the rise.
The peak for integration, at least for African American students, was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and we've really been in decline ever since.
65 years since Brown v. Board ordered the nation to desegregate its schools, we look at where school integration stands today. Also on the show, an advice podcast that wants to fill a gap in how we talk about race.
We don't have these conversations in public radio. We, as people of color, are rarely in conversation with each other about the impacts of racism and how to deal and heal from it.
And you've been telling us how being a military family has impacted your children.
One thing that has been certain our entire career has been the uncertainty.
Education is challenging for our children. People will only get so close because they're afraid that you're going to leave.
They didn't sign up for the life they were given.
We have a lot of you on the show today, so let's get started.
In May 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest tribunal in the land, carried this American ideal of public education another step forward.
Tomorrow marks the 65th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education.
In a unanimous decision, the 9 Supreme Court justices ruled racial segregation in publicly supported schools to be unconstitutional, declaring that it denied equal opportunity.
It was a major win for the civil rights movement that sought to level the playing field by giving everyone access to the same education.
They may speak with different accents. They may have different origins. They're all equal in the eyes of their country. They are the youth of America, a young and still growing nation, growing in the steady realization of its ideals of democracy and equality. In planning for public education, Americans have sought to give every youngster equal opportunity.
But that's not exactly how things have turned out.
Brown versus the Board of Education outlawed enforced racial segregation in American schools. But now there are signs that it could be making an unwelcome return.
Congress found the percentage of high poverty schools with mostly black or Hispanic students has more than doubled since 2000.
The percentage of black and Latino students in what's being called apartheid schools is on the increase. And yet most schools seem ill-prepared to help those students be the best they can be.
According to a study out this month from UCLA and Penn State, 65 years after the U.S. was supposed to have turned a corner, school segregation is actually on the rise. The share of intensely segregated minority schools, or schools that enroll 90 to 100% non-white students, has more than tripled since 1988. New York remains the most segregated state for African American students, with 65% of black students going to class in intensely segregated minority schools. And California is the most segregated state for Latinos. 58% are reported as attending segregated schools. And while the country is getting more diverse, the data shows that somewhere along the way, the 1954 plan for desegregation fell apart.
Equal opportunity.
That's where we begin today with two perspectives from those very states that lie at the extremes, New York and California. Laree Daniel Favors is general counsel at the Center for Law and Social Justice at Medgar Evers College CUNY, and Cecilia Rios Aguilar is professor and associate dean of equity, diversity, and inclusion at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Laree, let's start with you. New York, where we are sitting, is the most segregated state for black students. Why is that?
I think what we're seeing in New York City and throughout the country is that integration in schools is on the decline as a reflection of what's happening throughout our broader society. What's important to know is that the peak for integration, at least for African American students, was in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and we've really been in decline ever since. And when we look at the data that is out now, we really have to ask, was there any real political will to engage in a true effort at integration in the first place?
I want to ask a little bit about, you know, a lot of folks don't know that New York City is a very segregated city to begin with. Mm-hmm. How much of a factor is just the geographic segregation of New York in this?
Well, geographic segregation is always an issue, but when you're looking at a city like New York, which actually is experiencing high rates of gentrification, meaning the high influx of white residents, often upper middle class residents, into what is typically seen as low income black and brown communities, we're definitely seeing the influx in bodies. And while there is a slight uptick in the presence of white children at traditional public schools, it's just not there. And a lot of these families are still choosing to have their children educated in predominantly white spaces, even in a city as diverse as New York.
Cecilia, I want to bring you in here because often when we think about school segregation, we think in terms of black and white, but there is a different dynamic happening in California. There is a big picture of Latino segregation in California schools. Tell us a little bit about that.
Correct. As you mentioned before, right now, 58% of Latino students attend on average a school that is intensely segregated, meaning that 90 or 100% of students there are also Latinos. And we can't forget that in California, there's a case before Brown, and that also should be part of our intellectual history, because that case was fought in 1946, and it precedes Brown, and it has the exact same tones and the exact same importance as Brown, which is we want to give every single kid an equal opportunity to have education.
So you're talking about the Mendez v. Westminster case. What were the circumstances of that case?
The circumstances are that parents of Mexican origin children were denied access to Orange County schools. And the parents, Felicita and Gonzalo Mendez, bring a lawsuit against the school district and this particular school. So it's very similar, right? The educational opportunities and resources are neglected to a particular group of students, in this case, Mexican students.
Laurie, we're here in New York, and we know in New York and California the dynamics are different. But what about in the rest of the country? Are you seeing regional differences where segregation is more prevalent or less prevalent?
I think what we're seeing is that across the country, the trends tend to be the same. The numbers may differ slightly. You may have more white students in the Midwest region, for example. But regardless of where the students are located, the trends are the same. And what I think we have to now ask is 65 years later, with the data that we now have access to, integration is simply not a policy that is going to, it is designed to meet the needs of the vast majority of children in this country. It is a phenomenal goal. But children like my children, who live in a very hyper-segregated community and go to schools in a very hyper-segregated space, need an equitable distribution of resources. That is a policy. A mythical realignment of numbers to reach a magic point is simply not going to give our children what it is that they need, particularly because integration is really a stand-in or a metaphor for access to whiteness. And if we're talking about access to whiteness, access to white culture, access to opportunities, we have to recognize that even within integrated spaces, those opportunities and resources are not equitably distributed. Teachers, even in integrated spaces, need training on best practices and culturally responsive education. We do a lot of consulting in schools where there is a numeric blend, but the allocation of who's getting access to AP courses, who's getting referred to special ed, who's having incidences of discipline concerns, those are not equitable. And so even within integrated spaces, black and brown and white children are not getting access to the same education.
And that's a question I want to ask Cecilia also, because segregation does have effects, right? We're talking here about schools that aren't as segregated and there's still disconnects. But Cecilia, what impact does segregation have in terms of the quality of education that the students in that you study are getting?
Well, we have enough research to know the long-term consequences of these that are not just immediate educational, but there's relations to health, there's relations to employment, there's relation to incarceration rates. So there's a whole, what I would like people to understand is it has important consequences throughout the lives of kids. In the cases of Mendez and Brown, it was very well documented that the segregation fosters feelings of inferiority and rejection. Children, and also isolation delayed the acculturation and English language learning. And these are things that we can see still nowadays, that some kids have been living in these highly segregated circumstances that carry them throughout their college possibilities of attending college. In the case of California, they will attend sometimes community colleges, which are also the most highly segregated sector in post-secondary education. And then they end up with the lowest paying jobs. And we shouldn't be asking ourselves, why is this the case? We know exactly why, which is these high segregated situations.
You wanted to say something.
Yeah, I think that point is so salient and so important. And that's actually why we should have a much more culturally responsive approach to K through 12 education. recognizing that these are the outcomes that are tend to be produced in segregated education, that should then give us the ability to hyper-focus our resources and hyper-focus the targeting of programs for children who are coming out of schools that are underserved. I think it's time to move past having a conversation about the overall benefits of integration. We know what they are, and we know they remain elusive.
So why do they remain elusive? What is the holdup here? And I'm going to ask you the same question, Cecilia.
I think we have to look at the fact that right now, and the report even speaks to this, we are in an environment where a return to open and hostile racial white supremacy and the embrace of white nationalism is on the rise. That did not happen just as a result of Trump. Trump has allowed that those feelings to rise to the surface, but those feelings have been driving education policy since Brown. And we know that all deliberate speed meant as slow as possible for many schools. Immediately following Brown, nearly 90% of black principals were fired and nearly 40% of black educators were let go because white communities were not willing to have their children educated in the same spaces. So we need to go back and really look at what Brown missed and what we've missed over these past 65 years and provide black and brown children an education that is going to center their specific cultural and academic learning needs.
Cecilia, your thoughts on that? Because I will tell you, I am a product of the New York City public school system. My school was one of these intensely segregated schools. I did not get into an integrated school until I went to a specialized high school. So at what point, Cecilia, what needs to happen to make that the experience for other children?
It needs to happen very early. It needs to be strategic. It needs to be a policy priority. We need to incentivize school districts to look at voluntary integration. We need to have more resources, more funding. There's definitely the need for more federal funding, for more state funding, for more local funding to attend to this problem. This is not going to solve magically. And we need, yes, we need training on teachers, but we also need material resources and funding that goes to the school. It's not, again, going to magically happen one day, even if we set a goal. We
need tangible resources. Is there political will? I'm going to ask both of you because I think that's what's the holdup here.
Right.
Is just that these are great ideas, but we don't see them happening. Lurie.
I think we have to respond to the reality as it is today. We have the data now that looks back at what happened over the past 65 years. If our peak integration was in 1988 and we've been chasing that unicorn ever since, it's time for a policy that's going to be honest and clear about what children need today. The specialized high school program, is in great flux right here in New York City. But even if that program, which is now currently attempting to be revised, even if it were to work perfectly, we're talking about a handful of students. That's not an education policy. Black children, and we can go back as far as Carter G. Woodson and the Miseducation of the Negro, who talked about the fact that black children who are the descendants of those who were owned have a different educational need than white children who are the descendants of those who owned and have an entitlement to privilege, which is why even in those integrated spaces, white children carry a superiority complex and black and brown children carry an inferiority complex. And if our education policies are not designed to address that, the money we put into these schools will be meaningless because the heart of the issue is not being addressed.
Cecilia, we've got about a minute left in the segment. I want to address exactly what Lurie said, but for Latino students, we are in a very hostile environment right now for a lot of Latinos in the United States. How do we get past this, in your opinion? In a minute left.
The same thing. It's a policy that the Governor Brown passed, a local control funding formula, and is giving more funds to those schools in need that have high concentrations of low-income students, underrepresented students, foster youth, English language learners. So there's more resources going into these schools, but we need to make this a priority. It's not just that we expect the funding to get there. We need to make this a policy priority and now, because there's so much to be done, and this has important consequences.
Cecilia Rios Aguilar is Associate Dean of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies, and Lurie Daniel Favors is General Counsel at the Center for Law and Social Justice at Megar Evers College, CUNY. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
As we approach Memorial Day, we're asking military families about the biggest challenges they face. And many of you mentioned the impact on children.
I'm an adult military brat, and I'd say the primary issue still is that families being separated for extended tours of duty.
I've been an Army wife for 20 years, and the one thing that has been certain our entire career has been the uncertainty.
Their entire world stops life as normal when I deploy.
About a year has gone by that my husband hasn't missed one or multiple birthdays, anniversaries, or holidays.
People will only get so close because they're afraid that you're going to leave.
I grew up as a Navy brat. I wouldn't trade experiencing the world for anything, but I don't have any childhood friends. All my long-term friendships were formed after I struck out on my own.
Education is challenging for our children.
My husband had to go on to his next assignment without my son and I because we did not want to pull him out his senior year.
I feel that my children and I have served our country as well, albeit in a different way.
They didn't sign up for the life they were given.
We are your warriors. Our children will be your children's warriors.
Since 2001, more than 2 million American kids have had a parent deployed at least once. Studies show that while military children are resilient, when a parent is deployed, they can face higher rates of emotional and behavioral issues. Another reality of military life, regular moves, can also be disruptive for children. For more on how these situations impact children and military families, I sat down with Jamie Howard, a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute who specializes in anxiety disorders and trauma resiliency.
Some of the common problems are emotional difficulties and behavioral difficulties. We see both more anxiety, a little more depression, and a little more acting out behaviors. Having a parent who is deployed is a stressor for kids. Many studies have shown this. So whenever families are under stress, the children are more at risk of having some mental health problems or just adjustment difficulties.
What should parents be looking for, parents in general, but also parents of military, in military families, what should they be looking for in their children? How does anxiety manifest?
Yeah, anxiety manifests in lots of different ways. One is physiological symptoms. So they might have tummy aches in the little kids. They might have headaches. They might have muscle tension. They might have difficulty sleeping. Then there's the cognitive part of things, which is the thoughts they're having. So they might have a lot of intrusive thoughts about their parent being hurt if the parent is deployed, or worries about what's going to happen to the parent. And then there's also the behavioral component, which is avoidance. So ironically, sometimes a kid who really misses their parent might actually avoid talking to the parent or even try not to think about them because that's their way of trying to cope with the anxiety they're experiencing.
We interviewed a military mom, Katie Kirsch. Her husband is a pararescueman in the Air National Guard, and they have two children. One is 7 and one is 9. Let's take a listen to what Katie had to say.
They don't quite understand the danger involved, which is good. But the older they get it. Like one of my husband's coworkers passed away from a parachuting accident. And so every time my husband goes to jump, you know, they think about it and they ask about his friend. And they have a lot more worries than I think the average child growing up.
In Katie's situation, how can parents explain to their children the danger of what their partner or their father or their mother is about to go through?
I always recommend that parents emphasize the parent's training and the skill involved. It's similar to a parent who is a firefighter or a police officer. Those kids can worry, too, when their parent goes to work. And so what we always want to emphasize is your mom or your dad really knows what they're doing. They spend a lot of time training for this. Or in the training scenario, there's a lot of safety precautions in place, and everyone really wants them to be safe and they're smart and know what they're doing.
There's another element here for military families, and that's that they move a lot. Talk about how that impacts children.
Relocation is really tough on kids, especially when it's frequent relocation. And when you have a parent in the military and you're moving to a new place where there aren't a lot of other military families around you, kids can feel somewhat isolated. We don't exactly live in a uniformly military culture, so people will make mistakes, well-meaning all the time, like they'll refer to a Marine as a soldier. And that just sort of exposes that they're not familiar, really, with military. And that can make kids feel more isolated. Then for older kids who do have greater prevalence of problems with their parents being deployed and with moving, they're leaving their friends. So that's really tough. Older kids really rely on their friendships.
We also, we asked Katie about the stability that she tries to maintain in her family. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
They're always living in transition. Like, you know, we live in a rented home, and they know that this isn't our forever home. They are constantly seeing friends come and go. They're constantly seeing my husband come and go.
how it's a tough situation. Deborah, what can parents do to help children deal with those feelings?
Yeah, as much as possible, if you can have routines, like no matter where we are, we eat dinner at 6 o'clock and we always have pizza on Fridays and we bring your favorite pajamas everywhere we go and we have the same pictures. So as much as you can have some of those consistent routines for kids, that will be helpful. For mom, though, she also needs some support. The research is pretty clear that kids whose non-deployed parent is significantly stressed out or anxious or depressed, those kids have a really hard time.
We know that post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries impact veterans, but how does that translate to their children?
For those kids, it's really confusing and overwhelming for them to see these invisible injuries, especially, you know, a TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's hard to understand. They might just see that their dad is more angry or snaps more quickly, or just his personality seems different. Same case for moms. They won't necessarily develop PTSD from that because it doesn't technically count as a traumatic event for the child, but it certainly can cause an adjustment disorder, anxiety, stress, and sadness for the child.
There's a culture in the military, and that's probably similar to what we see in police culture, mm-hmm. which is also just being tough, toughing it out, you know, not showing a lot of emotion. Does that trickle down to kids in military families?
I think sometimes, for sure. If there's a family sort of ethos that we're brave, we're tough, which is true, and we don't seek mental health care, then that can be a problem for kids because they won't necessarily reach out to people who could be helpful, like their guidance counselor or some of their teachers. I think something that we really want to help the military community understand, and I think what we're getting somewhere with this is you can be brave and you can be tough and you can have post-traumatic stress disorder and you can get treatment for it, and it doesn't mean that there's any weakness there at all.
What are some of the positives? It's a tough conversation that we're having, but is there, you know, we talk a lot about resilience and grit. Are those things that also manifest in
children?
Yeah,
of course. So I remember one girl I worked with, her father was in the military. He was deployed into the Persian Gulf years ago, and he was also a firefighter. And she said, well, I know my dad's a hero, so that's what sort of helps me day to day when I know he's at work. And she's right. He's brave, and he is. Some people intentionally face dangerous situations in their life to help people. And so that's a really great thing to celebrate. And I see a lot of pride in a lot of military families. And some kids also really enjoy the travel, I would say. I've worked with some kids who've spent time in Italy and various places, and they thought of it as a really unique, exciting experience. And they don't necessarily have the predominant emotion of anxiety looming. They're more sort of, you know, happy, well-adjusted kids.
Jamie Howard is a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute. Thank you for joining us, Jamie.
Thank you.
You can find all of our coverage on the challenges facing military families at thetakeaway.org/homefront. Who do you turn to when you're looking for advice? A family member? Your best friend? Well, sometimes the best options are actually complete strangers, advice columnists. And even if you've never written in to ask for help in your own life, there's plenty to learn from reading about other people's struggles.
I have always been obsessed with advice. Ever since I was a little girl, I'd get the newspaper and I'd go to Dear Abby or Dear Anne. And as I started reading magazines growing up, I was always looking at the advice. They're entertaining, but you also glean a bit of something that you can take in your everyday life.
That's Tanya Mosley, the Silicon Valley Bureau Chief for KQED. She's also the host of the podcast called Truth Be Told, which Tanya uses to correct a glaring oversight she found throughout most mainstream advice columns.
Anytime an advice column took on issues around race or identity, there was a centering of whiteness in a way that was very implicit. So there was a column just last fall where Dear Abby received a letter from an Indian father who said, I'm not sure if I should name my child an Indian name. My wife wants to. I'm afraid about his future in this country, having an Indian name. And Dear Abby actually responded and said, you should not burden your son with an Indian name. And I was just floored by this advice because, first of all, we live in a diverse country where we all have different names, and these names are connected to our cultures, and they're very important to us. And if we're going to embrace that, we have to have different names and learn how to say different names. You have a name, Tanzina. I'm sure when you grew up, you probably had folks have problems at some point with your name. And that's because there is like this real push for us to assimilate and have names that really speak to the centering of whiteness.
You workshopped the show by talking to focus groups of people of color in the Bay Area before you decided to move forward with this. What was some of the feedback that you got from those sessions?
That's right. So my producer, Christina Kim, and I had several sessions with community members of color in the Bay Area, and we workshopped this idea of having an advice show for and by people of color. And one thing that we found that was a real takeaway for me and confirmation for me is that we as people of color are rarely in conversation with each other about the impacts of racism and how to deal and heal from it. And I want to be very specific to say we don't have these conversations in public radio. But these are public radio listeners, give or take, who say, you know, when I hear conversations around race and racism, it's often to a white audience. But I really want to be able to have conversations with other people of color around the issues that we're dealing with and how to solve these issues. But then also just someone who will understand, and we can have a conversation at a certain point where we're not having to start from the beginning to explain everything before we get to the meat of the issue.
So, Tanya, the second episode of your show is about interracial relationships. Let's take a listen to this listener question that prompted you to cover that topic.
I'm in a relationship with someone who I didn't think I would actually initially be attracted to. So I'm wondering, how can I navigate my relationship and be authentic to my desires, but also be critical of the ways in which the narratives I've absorbed about who's attractive have affected my sexuality.
What did the listener want you to explore when it came to interracial attraction?
Oh, well, this is one of my favorite shows, for truth be told. And we were unpacking colonized desire. And so let me explain a little bit about colonized desire. We have an expert, Amy Tsuyoshi. She's the Dean of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University. And she basically says colonized desire is when the colonized person, say me as a Black person, has a set of beliefs around beauty and value that's based on the colonial power that has colonized them. So I could be, for instance, a woman of color who likes white men because I see them as the pinnacle of authority and culture and intellect. So colonized desire might also not be seeing yourself or your people beautiful or worthy of love. And the person who wrote to us basically was saying, all of my life, I have loved white men. Think about like beach babes, blonde hair, blue eyes. But I find myself in this loving relationship with someone who does not have all of those qualities. And because of that, I'm kind of like checking my desires, because I'm thinking like, this is the first time I've really been in this type of relationship. And what has led me here? And then also, what are the reasons why I find myself desiring whiteness over my own people?
You also look at, in the interracial relationships episode, relationship between people of color. Tell us about that.
This is really important because, you know, when we think about what we see in the media around interracial love, it is often Black and white. And we never really see other types of couples and other types of love out there to show us that there is a possibility for that. And what does that look like? So we wanted to explore what that looks like. And we were able to do that through a lovely couple, an Asian and Black couple, who talks about some of the challenges they deal with in the day-to-day, but then also how they would love to see more of themselves in everyday life.
I think if people were to see more diverse representations of interracial couples, you know, specifically two people of color together,
right. Then
that would open their horizons to who they date.
Using the term people of color is something that I use quite often. There are lots of folks who use it. But there have been, you know, there's some criticism about the term as well, that it's not specific mm-hmm. enough, that it sort of lumps us all into one category, and that's not fair. Why did you feel like this one was the right one for your show?
We were very intentional in using the term people of color. For one, we live in the Bay Area, and it's a diverse area, and we want it to be able to not only represent the Bay Area, but really the United States at large. I'm a Black woman. My producer is Korean Spanish. My editor is South Asian American. So it really is the best definer for us on this show and who we're making this show for. And as you said, there has been a pushback on the term because really it erases blackness for some people. But I wanted to acknowledge where this came from and really reclaim the word. So back in the 70s, people of color was coined as a phrase to communicate solidarity between non-white women. And that was very powerful for me. So while the term people of color in many instances today, we're taking a second look at it and thinking about, is it erasing the identities of people? I wanted to reclaim it for this show and say, hey, we are intentional in talking about people of color coming in conversation with each other, Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian folks, all coming together to have discussions around race and racism, and really being able to learn from each other, but also comfort each other, talk about ways that we can not only survive, but we thrive in this country and in this world. And so it was very important and very intentional to reclaim that term.
In the first episode of the show, one of the people you asked for advice was your grandmother. And I'd like to talk a little bit about us over 35 people of color and perhaps the under 35 cohort. Do we have anything to teach younger people of color?
This is such a good question, Tanzina, because it was very important to me to also think about having a multi-generational wise one. And the wise ones are experts on the show. I think that oftentimes we discount older people's perspectives. And it's because, you know, we're an ageist society. Let's be real. So we, you know, you get over a certain age and we kind of have our focus on the millennials and younger. I know because I love my grandmother and my grandmother's so full of advice. She's so wise that I wanted to be able to have her on to talk about her perspective. When you're in your 90s, I mean, the life that you've lived and what you've been able to teach young people, it's just amazing. And it really resonates with everyone who's listened to the show. And for our age, Tanzina, I think that oftentimes people skip over us, but there's a lot of value in the life we've lived. And I think we have a lot of advice to give young people. And so that was very important to me, too, to have people of different ages on the show to be able to talk and give advice because we've lived life. We know a few things.
Tanya Mosley is the host of KQED's Truth Be Told and the Silicon Valley Bureau Chief for KQED. Tanya, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.